You can have all the Explorations Early Learning Upstairs Studio podcast with our new app. Just search your app store, Apple, Android, Kindle. We don't care what you use. Search the app store for Explorations Early Learning. Download the app. Give it a try. Welcome to the Child Care Bar and Grill podcast. I'm Jeff Johnson coming to you live from Upstairs Studios. In the studio, I've got Lisa Murphy.
Hello.
Travis Taggart.
Hi.
We've got Tiffany running the soundboard.
That's me.
Tiffany, we never say your last name. You got a last name, don't you?
I do. It's hard to say, so everyone's like, Tiffany.
It's Pearsall, right?
It's Pearsall.
Yeah, I can say it. I just forget to sometimes. I apologize for that. And on the phone from 15 hours in the future... The pride of Australia. We've got my buddy Nikki Buchan. Nikki spent she spent 2.5 weeks or about that chauffeuring Tasha and I around Australia last year.
I'm sorry.
and she still talks to me. So it was delightful. Nikki, how you doing?
I'm doing very well. I've just been hand feeding the kookaburras on my veranda. Yeah, so that was exciting.
Remember the
look at Travis's face.
Okay, so remember the show Beretta back on TV in the 70s and 80s,
well,
whatever.
I do, yeah,
because you're old, like, and that bird that sat on Beretta's shoulder.
Yeah,
they like come to Nikki's house for breakfast anymore. Like all of them in Australia come to Nikki's patio in the morning.
I know that song, the kookaburra sits in the gum tree.
And it's, I was watching video. They just kind of and we were recording and they were yelling at her for not feeding her
that's
on time.
Not the bird that
no,
was
that's
on Beretta's
a, no,
shoulder.
But that's not the ones.
No,
that were
those are the.
Yeah, that was the cockatiel. That was the cockatiel. But these guys are there too. But I'm talking about the other guys were there when we were recording the other day.
These guys?
No, the Beretta birds, the cockatiels.
Oh, sorry,
cockatoos.
Cockatoos.
But these guys, there's freaking birds all over Australia. It's amazing.
That's awesome.
It's big loud birds.
Yeah, those guys. They're like the size. They're like.
Tell her what you're seeing that she doesn't know you're seeing.
She knows what she.
No, but you're looking at a screen and pointing and getting excited.
But all she's
got to
do is
see that.
All she's got to do is look out her window, and they're these giant, big, white, beautiful birds with the yellow crests, and they beg for food, and they're the size of small children.
Yes, definitely, they are the size. They eat as much as big children.
It's amazing.
And they're hungry birds, apparently.
It's amazing. And so I wanted to talk to Nikki. We're going to do a couple episodes with her. I wanted in this episode to talk about nature play, and specifically nature play around the world, because Nikki gets around. Nikki's recently been in South Korea and back to South Africa, where she grew up, and she spent years of her career working in Scotland, and she's been all over. And I love the idea of kids being out in nature, and I love the idea hearing about how it happens around the world. So, Nikki, what do we need to know about the value of nature play and the way it happens in different parts of the world?
Well, I think first of all, we need to look at, you know, what do children like to do, and they love to play, and children need to play for their development. And what fascinates me is, never mind where I am in the world, children play, do the same things. They all build shelters. They all like to climb. They all like to collect natural objects, their little treasures. And although the material might be different, you know, for example, if I'm working in the Shetland Islands don't have many trees. So trees to children are really valuable. Anything from a tree is really valuable. Whereas the sea, which surrounds them, the shells aren't as valuable to them. So it just fascinates me how children create treasures out of scarce natural objects. Those become the sort of favorite treasures. Do you find similar in the U.S.?
Oh yeah, I mean here in Iowa, I've had kids that have asked me to, you know, if they hear I'm going to. Going to Florida, where we keep the ocean, I'm told that bring me back a shell, and that kind of stuff. And other places, it's pine cones, because out in California, they've got these pine cones that are the size of your head. And so, yeah, depending on where you are, the thing that's scarce is the thing that you are drawn to, probably, huh?
Yes, and they become the treasures. And then even things like in Scotland, the children used to make snow angels. You know, they lie in the snow and then they flap their arms up and down and then they get up and then there's an angel. And then when I came to Australia, they were doing the same in the sand.
In the sand, sand angels. Of course they were. And so it's really neat that so many of those things are, it almost seems instinctual.
Yes. I think it's an urge and maybe it's something that's passed on from generation to generation, is that, you know, this is what we made. And this is how we played. And I was fascinated with, or I am fascinated with, how children in different countries play the same way. Korea impressed me. I was asked to speak at a conference in Korea with a lovely group of people. And I was very privileged to go and visit a couple of centers that do forest school, or the forest school, the nature-based practice approach, where the children spend long periods of time in nature. And what is amazing with Korea is that within an eight or ten year period, because it has become a sort of a national movement, 20% of the early childcare environment actually the children have access to nature in some form in a forest school sort of approach. And I think that's amazing to have 20% of your children having access to wild spaces.
Well, especially in that short time span.
Yes. Yes. And the models are different in every country. You know, in the UK, the first forest schools, were brought over from the Scandinavian countries, and it's a really good concept. Sadly, it sort of evolved into a very often a six-week block where children spend the morning in the forest, very often attached to schools, which is brilliant, so the children do get that time outdoors. Some of it is, I think some schools don't quite get it. And what's happening there is that they are expecting the forest school leaders to, can you do the Gromans in the forest today?
The what?
So
sorry?
They're trying to link it. Can you do the Romans? You know, so trying to link it to a curriculum focusing on.
Sorry, yes, I got it now.
I'm amazed by the freedom children have in nature in other parts of the world compared to here in the States. We were talking in another recording that we did, and you were telling me about children and knives in Germany.
Yes, the children actually arrive in the school. So we went to visit a little school, a nursery in Germany called Waldwichtel, and the children actually get dropped off in the car park, in the forest, by their parents, with knives hanging from their backpacks. They have food, they have their breakfast in there, everything in their spades, the whole lot attached to their backpacks, and that's how they go in. The parents don't know where they're going, because they just dropped off at the car park, and then the children decide where they want to go.
Oh my God, this is awesome.
It is. It is awesome. So the children have a number of sites that they like to visit. And then they'll decide once the children are there where we're going to go. And what I loved was, as you say, the freedom. So the children could have breakfast whenever they wanted to, because it was in their backpack. So some children sat down, and as soon as they got to a settling space, the children sat down, and some opened their thermos and had hot porridge out of their thermos while others went off to play. And then closed it up and went off to play and then came back and had another course. That real freedom. And all they had with them was whatever they carried in their backpacks.
I'm fascinated by that. We recorded an episode a little bit earlier today, and Travis was telling a story about how in his program they've recently had a problem with licensing because children were crawling up the fence a little bit to see what was going on the other side of the fence. And across the ocean in Germany, children are showing up with knives hanging from their backpack and able to choose when they want to eat and choose where they want to go play in the forest. So there's a lot of range in what we allow in childcare. Now Travis worked with his licensing people, and there was no big deal finally about the climbing up on the fence, but there were people complaining about it as if that's a real risk and danger for children. So I'm imagining, since children are you know, they're not cautious and they're not careful. Having those knives in their backpack means children in Germany are getting stabbed all the time, right?
Nope. No. And you know, even I was outside my comfort zone, because the children would pick up these knives, and they weren't, you know, I use knives with children, but I use the short 1-inch blades. Uh-huh. You know, so they're fairly short, they're sharp, but they've only got a short blade. These children have got, some of them have got 3-4-inch blades, and they'll just pick them up, and they'll sit there, and they'll whittle, or they'll carve something whenever they want to. This, you know, not necessarily with an adult supervising, you know, which it would put a lot of people outside their comfort zone, but these children have grown up with that philosophy, and these children know how to take care of themselves. Whereas I think a lot of our children, because the adult is always protecting them and always there to tell them what's safe and what's not safe, they don't have to think. They can just do.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. And we do a lot to...
Story with the... Sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
And I was saying the lovely story that you were telling about Travis's center with children. You know, unless children don't really climb a fence to get away unless there's something wrong inside the fence.
So yeah,
I don't see anything wrong with climbing a fence. It's something to climb, and you know they're not climbing with the purpose of getting out.
Yeah,
and even if they did, you know, you have a conversation about it.
Do we assume that? Like, why do we project that onto that? Like, maybe we on some level know that what's happening inside the fence is something you should be running away from.
Their goal.
Maybe the teachers wish that they were climbing over the fence.
Yeah, the kids' goal in doing that is we're smack dab in a high traffic area of a city. And we've got so many noises outside of a privacy fence, and they've got these little supports that they can climb up on to look over. That's all they want to do, is to look over the fence and see what's out there. See what's making all those noises. We're next to a fire station, for God's sake.
Oh my God.
All the noises that come through there. Yeah. They just want to see over it, and people get so freaked out. That and the fact that
I would build
wood.
Platforms.
Yeah, build platforms so they can get up there and
viewing platforms.
Yeah, yeah.
It's reminding me of a story that I totally just forgot about until you guys are talking about this. There was a school that I was doing some observation with in Arizona, and the children had rolled a table of some sort over to the chain link fence that separated the schoolyard from a vacant lot. And these two little boys would climb up on it every day. I totally had forgotten about this. And they thought, do you know the children's book, Abby Yo-Yo? Have you heard of this book? Abby Yo-Yo?
I haven't.
You have not? Mm-hmm. Abby Yo-Yo.
No, I haven't. I will look it up.
Abby Yo-Yo. Well, Abby Yo-Yo is this, it's a, I don't want to say a fairy tale. It's not. It's a legend, and it's a United States, a Southern story. And Abby Yo-Yo had stinky teeth because he never brushed them, and long fingernails because he never cleaned them.
Oh, yes.
And the children had convinced themselves that Abby Yo-Yo lived in the vacant lot. So they would climb up, and they'd look over the fence, and then they'd scream, which is actually a phrase from the book. Abby Yo-Yo is coming, and then they would run through the yard because Abby Yo-Yo was coming. And I watched this, and I would watch all of the teachers. Their first instinct was get off the table, right? Get off the and what we would have missed if we had enforced that. Pete Seeger. Pete Seeger wrote it.
I think that they're so curious, and they're so engaged, and they're so excited about the world, and we infantilize them and make them make them feel incapable of so much. And the reality is, when we free them up just a little bit, there's so much learning available to them. When Tasha and I were over in Australia, and Nikki was chauffeuring us around and showing us the wonders, one of the things we got to do was visit a primary school that is pretty much a forest school. So their classrooms have been converted to sometimes places, and they spend a couple days a week out in nature. And these two girls, probably 8-9 years old, had volunteered to show us around, and they were doing this amazing stuff, you know, showing us that, you know, you climb up this tree, this arched branch, and over a path, and you know, you climb up here and you sit real still, and then the kangaroos will come out, and you can see the kangaroos from here. And they're showing us where we're over here is where the koalas show up, and I start asking them, you know, Australia is dangerous. Everything they tell me, I'm an American, I don't know anything about anything, and all the creatures in Australia are trying to kill you, and bugs and spiders and snakes and
crocodiles.
And aren't you worried about this? And the girl said, "Well, No, we don't bother them. Those critters are probably around here, but we don't mess with them. And so they're mindful of the environment. And children are very good at that when we trust them, huh, Nikki?
Yes, definitely. And that particular school, it's a beautiful school called Upper Sturt. Those children, and I've spent quite a lot of time with those children, they call me Nikki Nature because they've got a teacher called, another teacher called Nikki.
They have another Nikki.
So when I go, they call me Nikki Nature because I'm always the one that is out in the bush with them or the forest with them. But what fascinates me is their knowledge of the natural environment. The gates are open, so the children could leave the property if they wanted to, but they know that, you know, those are the boundaries, that they stay within those very big boundaries. But the one day I went, this little boy was telling me about all the orchids growing in there. And even though he said to me, "You're late, Nature Nikki. I said, "What am I late for?" He says, "You've missed the orchids." Oh. But he was able to take me to all the spaces where all you saw was little shriveled sticks. And he said, "That's a slipper orchid and that's a so-and-so orchid." So he knew exactly what was everywhere. And another time I was there, we were sitting around the fire with the children because they start the day around the fire, sort of a big campfire, having conversations. And he wandered off, and the head teacher said, "That's fine, let him wander off." And he went out of sight, he disappeared, and then he came back really excited. "Nature Nikki, come and look. I found an orchid that hasn't been discovered yet."
Oh.
And in amongst the trees, he'd found a little plant, and it was one that they hadn't identified previously. And the excitement, and if the teachers had insisted on him staying around the campfire, he wouldn't have had that experience. It's just amazing, and they can climb trees as high as they want to. There's a lot of freedom for those children, and no behavioral issues at all. Because it's a small school, you know, often small schools tend to attract children that don't settle very well in a more conventional big classroom.
Uh-huh.
But these children were just amazing. And I've never seen children being as helpful towards each other as I saw this group of children being.
Oh, very, very polite and very, very concerned about the well-being of others. And the staff was so, and this was a new, this is a new structure for the school too. And so the staff were still getting used to the freedom and openness and process of using nature. And while we're visiting a little guy, he took Nikki and I off on an adventure during a break, and he had to go show us some anthills. And he drug us clear to the far side, the far boundary of the property, and I'm kind of like, "Aren't you gonna have to get back for class pretty soon?" And he's like, yeah, but I'm with you, so I'm probably not gonna get in trouble." And they ring the bell and everything, and he shows back a few minutes late, and he's like, "Hey, I was showing these guys the anthill, and life's good." And so there's not the rigidity that I think we get a lot of times in settings here in the state as well.
I'm locked and loaded on two things. One, we start our day around a fire, okay, which in my world is awesome and is like scaring the daylights out of most of our listeners. And another one is like about maybe 5 or even 10 minutes ago, Nikki, you said the German parents who dropped their kids off at the trailhead with a backpack and a machete and a snack, and they don't even know where they go. Look at the trust.
Yeah,
that
on both sides.
I'm loving that, and that's all I got. I have nothing profound other than being amazed and inspired by that.
It's an amazing thing, Nikki. We did an episode a while ago yesterday about fire safety. We found this post on Pinterest.
Don't insult what she's doing by even talking about.
I want to make a very clear comparison. There was a fire safety post on Pinterest about how teaching fire safety to a 3-year old. You're supposed to take a red plastic cup and you turn 3 of them upside down, and you take some construction paper and you
yellow
cut out,
and orange.
You cut out flames, and then you let the child use a little squirt gun
to knock that down to turn the fire off.
To teach fire safety. Nikki, how do you teach fire safety?
We make real fires.
And say, "Don't touch it."
I've got beautiful video footage of working with sort of 12, 18-month-old toddlers around a real fire.
Where can we see that?
I can send it to you. That would be
awesome. E.T., are you ready for this?
And then the educator or the practitioner just sort of demonstrates that you put your hands above and then you take them off again. You know, you test the temperature.
Uh-huh.
And like you know, when we talk about, because children know fire is hot. Even a baby knows when something is red and you go close to it and there's heat. They're not going to put their hands into it.
They're not stupid.
They're not stupid. And I think, you know, maybe when we talk about risk, that will come out more. But, you know, these little toddlers, they know about fire and children have a fascination. And, you know, in Australia and I know in the U.S. as well, you have, you know, fire has catastrophic consequences. You know, we have these runaway fires which kill people and destroy, you know, sometimes hundreds of homes. And I think, you know, for watching the news that you have that as well, do you?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. In certain regions, yes.
Yeah, and you see, and I feel really strongly that our role as educators, and a lot of children spend more time with us than they spend at home, one of our roles is to help the children keep themselves safe. And one of the things that children have a fascination for and that they will experiment with is fire. So we're better off, you know, working with fire in a supervised environment, which is the childcare environment, you know, the childcare setting where you have got enough adults. It can be supervised, it can be monitored, and to teach children about fire so they know, you know, how far to keep away, not to run around the fire. You know, they know about how to put fires out. I asked a little Australian boy when I first got here, how do you put a fire out? He was a 10-year-old, and he told me you blow it, which obviously is the opposite to what you do.
Yeah.
And to me, that's more dangerous than the child actually really knowing. And when I do professional development and I ask the audience, how many of you in your childhood made fires in secret? I would say probably about 70 or 80% made fires. And I've had people tell me they made fires in the hay shed because that was the only place they could get away from the adults.
Mm.
And there's no hay shed anymore. People made fires under their beds, behind the shed, or in the bush. So I just think my motto is always, you know, we have to support children in keeping themselves safe.
Yeah,
we can't be there all the time.
You take this thing that they're interested in, you take it out of the shadows and you bring it into the forefront of their environment and help them be responsible and mindful with engaging with it.
And I've worked with very young children with fires for 50 years. And in the Scandinavian countries, they have a fire pit unattended by adults. So there's a fire pit with the fire going and the children come and go and not necessarily an adult there. I do have an adult, you know, usually present near the fire, so that it can be part of your sort of teaching moment. But and when I went to Norway and spent a day with a group of children, and we went up into a public park. Now, it was deep snow. The snow was probably about 2-3 feet deep. So the children dug into the snow, and then they dug into the soil, and then they made a fire in there, and they cooked their food on there, and they'd go off skiing. Again, with no adults necessarily totally out of sight, they've got their little skis on, and then they go off skiing, or they've got these little shoes. You know, these like they look like tennis rackets tied to their feet.
Yeah, the snowshoes.
The snowshoes, and they go off, you know, and disappear and along the pathway. And when they get cold, they come back and they come around this fire that's been dug into in this sort of. They might eat something hot off the fire, and then they go off again. In all my years of working with fire with children, the worst injury I've had was a 10-year-old who touched a marshmallow straight off the fire, and he had a little red mark on his fingers. That was the worst injury I've had in 30 years of working with fire with children. Mm-hmm. But you see, because it's fire is a natural element, and it's one of the, Dr. Sanset had identified it as one of the risky play behaviors that children are fascinated in.
Yeah.
This, you know, this urge, this primitive urge we have to explore fire, like we explore all the other elements. You know, we're allowed to explore water and sand and all of that, but the one that we exclude is fire. So it might be starting with candles. And again, in a lot of the Scandinavian countries and a lot like the Frobelian approach is to have candles, you know, on tables within children's spaces. Even the toddlers and babies have got little tea light candles standing around because the worst injury is a tiny burn on the finger, you know. But that's a better lesson than waiting till later on and when it can be so much worse. But I think it's part of nature. And because children are elements of nature, they're going to want to explore it.
Absolutely. So, Nikki, one of the things I hear from programs about outdoor nature experiences is the weather becomes a big thing. We had somebody post on Facebook not too long ago that their program was not allowed to go outside if it looked like it was going to rain. And so weather seems to scare people away from scare adults away from outside play. And my experience is that if you dress appropriately and are aware of how to be mindful in the whatever kind of weather it is, kids are pretty resilient and pretty engaged in different kinds of weather. I mean, you're in Australia where it gets hot, hot, hot. And you were just telling a story about Norway where it gets cold, cold, cold with lots and lots of snow. And so children are able to adjust and function and play and learn and all kinds of different weather, aren't they?
Definitely. If you look at the Inuits, or some people call them Eskimos, they've got snow all year round. Those children play in the snow. I don't know what people think is going to happen, whether children are going to melt or whether they think children are going to absorb the water and become like sponges.
Uh-huh.
The weather doesn't affect the children. And what's interesting is the children play in a different way. So in Australia, yes, we do have days when we can get to 40 degrees. I don't know what that is in
That's like 110, 115, I think.
Flaming 40s.
Yeah, it's
tech support says 104.
Oh, there we go.
Okay.
That's a hot day.
It's a hot day, but what happens then is the children seek shade, and they love playing then with water, and their movement slows down, so they're not as energetic, but they're still playing, but they might be sitting on the ground just playing in the water. So children adapt according to that, and I think in some ways we are causing a lot of problems by having air-conditioned environments, which means, number one, the educator doesn't want to go outside because mm-hmm. it's too hot, and the children don't adapt as well. I grew up in South Africa where the temperature gets as hot. Air conditioning hadn't really been invented in those days. Now I'm giving away my age. But air conditioning hadn't been, and we coped. We adjusted. And I think a lot of our children, they don't know what it feels like to be cold. They don't know what it feels like to be hot because we're constantly regulating the temperature for them instead of letting them go and explore it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that. I thinking about it this winter, you go out and it's fresh snow, and you go out and you shovel, and maybe you didn't dress as warm as you should have, and you're freezing, and then you walk back in to the warm house. And I love that transition that, that was a little bit miserable, but I survived it. That kind of feeling, I think that's good for us as
human beings. I win weather.
Yay me. And so when we're sitting in the air conditioning all the time with our iPads, we really do not learn how to acclimate to the outside world. And that's kind of probably a loss for us.
In Denmark, I visited Denmark, and they've got babies sleeping outside until it gets to minus 15 degrees. So these little babies are, beautifully covered, little snowsuity sort of outfits. They wake them up after 2 hours because they sleep so well, because it's fresh air. And there's no adult standing next to them. They've got a baby monitor. Most of the centers had sort of a shed, an open shed, and the babies and their prams were pushed in there. They had the baby monitors in there so they could hear what was happening. And the baby slept, and they slept extremely well.
I think sometimes we forget that people were like having babies, like procreating, living, and doing like life way before we learned how to have air conditioning and heaters and circle time carpets. We were doing this before, and we did it really well, or we wouldn't still be here. It's like we don't trust ourselves anymore.
Yes, I sort of wonder about the future of our children if everything is so regulated and they can't cope with being in the heat and they can't cope with being in the cold. Is that because we're not allowing them to sort of that acclimatize? And Jeff mentioned that you get the sense of tribe, if you've been in a group and you've been out in the snow and you've got little red noses and little red cheeks and, cold little fingers because you've lost your mittens along the way. And then you come back and you sit around the fire. It's the sense of tribe, we've overcome this together.
Yeah,
I think is a strong feeling that children have.
And it also builds this personal resilience that I think we lack in a lot of the world nowadays too. And I hate thinking kids today, but I mean the reality is when we don't challenge ourselves, whether it's outside in the environment or other aspects of our lives, it's hard to build the habit of resilience, of being able to stand up and persevere and make it through whatever challenge is facing you in life, whether it's a physical challenge like being out in the cold or an emotional challenge like having your sweetie pie tell you they don't love you anymore, those kind of things. And when we don't have that resilience, it makes life a little bit more challenging.
It definitely does. But so, does Travis, do your children have access to the sort of nature spaces?
At my little center that's smack dab in the middle of a city, no, we have no access to. I mean, we have our outdoor playground. We try to incorporate as much as we can, but there is nothing within even a 10-mile radius that they could get their hands on. However, at the new center we just started, right across the street, there's a gully for storm drain water that is like bursting with life, and it's owned by the city, so we can just walk on over to it and hang out, and the kids go right up to the water. It's about a 3-foot drop from where they would be standing to where the surface of the water is, and they just sit there like looking to see if there's any tadpoles. Always, there never are, but they're always looking. Stuff like that, and they experiment. They go around to they've got a lot of trees that have thorns on them, so they go and identify those, find those, make sure everybody knows where they are, and they try to like touch it, touch all the thorns, all that stuff. But it's not a very like there's no depth to that area that they can go to. I mean, it's right alongside the street, so they have to kind of stay like we kind of stay further away from the street, but after a certain point you're past that little area of wooded area and then you're into the suburb again. Right in somebody's backyard, so they get a good taste. There's a lot of natural. Yeah, there's a lot of raw materials out there. There's a lot of stuff that they can do, a lot of conversations that the teachers can facilitate. But when they move, if they step a little too far out one way, they're in somebody's backyard and kind of the magic gets lost because they want to go so much deeper. They really want to go so much further into it. And they never make it.
And so Nikki, we're getting close to time to wrap this one up. But before we go, we always try to leave listeners with something practical. If a program is in an urban setting, say, and they've got their outdoor play space, and a lot of them are half covered in asphalt or concrete and that kind of stuff. And how can programs that don't have ready access to the forest or the bush or the beach implement more nature play, more of these experiences into the lives of the children they serve?
I think there's an awful lot you can do. And, not everybody has a paradise around them that can really explore. I think making sure you've got all the elements, so making sure that there's access to water in multiple ways. So, having water that flows, even if it's flowing out of a hose pipe, water that trickles, water that sprays, just all of that. I would introduce fire, especially because that's a very contained, very safe environment. So that's one of the other elements. Soil, again, it could be even having planters with some herbs growing in it, and children can make their dinosaur homes and their fairy houses in the planters with, actually having access to the soil. And then obviously being outside, you've got the wind, you've got the sun, you've got the dappled light of shade. So there is an awful lot of nature that we can introduce. And it's also, planting plants that attract bugs. There's certain plants that would attract the butterflies. So to plant those and having a little bug hotel, but just
a couple
of pallets with lots of little holes where you could have bugs going in there and children could explore that. So there is a lot you can do within a center that doesn't cost a lot of money.
I have to pause you. I have to stop you. We did not know what did you say a bug hotel?
Yes, a bug hotel.
Travis is writing something down. And E.T. just put a picture up on our screen.
I used to make those and I totally forgot.
You forgot you used to do
that
this.
That just brought me all the way back. That was crazy.
I stayed in a hotel that had bugs once, but I have never myself heard of a bug hotel. This is awesome.
Yeah, there's so much fun to
Tiffany is showing us pictures.
I haven't done this yet.
Tiffany is showing us pictures.
With a bug hotel, they can just have baskets and you put a couple of like bamboo bits in it and a couple of things with holes in so the bugs can go in there. So it can be a basket. Some people use pallets depending on your space.
Uh-huh.
And again, they get the children to put reeds and sticks and stuff in there and it'll attract the bugs. Even a bit of carpet that gets wet and then you can pick it up and you'll get the slaters or the, you know, the little bugs in there. So they tend to call it a bug hotel because you have all these different bugs that like to come and live in that space. You've made it available to them.
Yeah, so even if you're...
Travis's brain just like flew out of his head and is all over the podcast studio right
well,
now.
Well, we know what Travis is going to be doing at his program for the rest of the week, building bug hotels. I can't wait to see the posts.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome.
Oh, Tiffany is pulling up pictures of some very
it's
fancy stuff.
It's a bug mansion.
There's some pretty fancy stuff out there.
You can create a bug play park too. You
know? Yeah, like yeah, that's what the, that's bugs, what these look like.
How sad that the bugs. Okay, so your bugs in your country have a better play environment than some of the children in ours.
And so,
I can send you some photographs of bug hotels.
Oh, that would be awesome.
Nikki, we don't have to be out in the middle of nature. We don't have to be in the middle of the forest, in the middle of the bush to engage nature. We can invite it to our urban play spaces if we're not as lucky as some programs that get to be forest schools. I really like the idea also, in addition to what you said, about importing the bits and pieces of nature, you know, the pine cones and the sticks. I've met programs that are completely urban and their outside play space is completely covered in concrete that actually bring in sticks so the kids have sticks to build shelters and fairy houses and those kind of cubbies and those kind of things with. So it's not a complicated thing, is it?
No, it isn't. In Australia, they went through a phase where we got rid of all the sort of natural surfaces and people put that horrible rubber.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Oy.
Yeah. Artificial surfaces. And a lot of people spent a fortune on doing that. There's been a lot of research and one of the researchers at Sydney University actually has identified that there's been a 20% increase in injury since we've had those artificial surfaces. So they're not necessarily safer. In fact, I think they're more dangerous.
Yeah, because we think they're safer. So
and
we
a
get...
lot of people don't have a budget to lift them.
Yeah.
So what I've been saying to people is you can actually just put stuff on top. You can cover it with sand. You can cover it with bark chips, you know, so that the children have a natural environment they're walking on. And underneath is still your artificial, but nothing to stop you from putting stuff on top.
On top of it. And I think we're still in the phase here in a lot of places where installing that stuff is the big rage. And so I'm hoping the pendulum swings back to the dirt and mud and sand and pea gravel and those kind of things. Well, got something, Tiffany?
We have pea gravel, and I love it.
I don't love my pea gravel. It's everywhere. It's the entire playground. I want to pull it up and put at least some sod down.
Oh. Well, you guys are going to have to...
Okay, that and we're about to segue into...
Tiffany and Travis are going to have to arm wrestle over the benefits of pea gravel in a little bit. Hey, Nikki, this has been great. I got to throw this out there. Nikki's presented and visited lots of programs all over the world. She's presented all over the place. Never presented in the States yet. And it's getting to the point where it's kind of upsetting me a little bit. So if you're listening to this podcast and you're looking to book a presentation, get a hold of Nikki and I promise you that she will come and give you a presentation that'll blow your mind and leave you thinking, because I traveled around Australia listening to her and talking with her and she's got everybody needs to experience the goodness that Nikki has to offer. And so Nikki, how do people get a hold of you?
You're very flattering, Jeff. I really enjoyed my time traveling with you because we were like children discovering stuff together. Which
we had a good time.
Oh, my heart is happy to hear this. You made Jeff have a feeling.
You could all come. Travis, I invite you, and Lisa, I invite you as well. So you could all come, and I'll take you on a trip. Or you can take me on a trip in the U.S.
Oh, if you're ever in Australia, you need a tour guide. Nikki's the one. Nikki, how do listeners get a hold of you? Yeah, where do they find you on Facebook? How do they get a hold of you if they want to connect with you and learn more from you?
Okay, on Facebook, I'm obviously under my name, Nikki Buchan. I'm there. we've also got a Facebook called Nature Pedagogy. I think it's called Nature Pedagogy International. You're welcome to come onto that. Otherwise, there's Nature-Based Practice International. There's also, you can email me, and my email is nikkibucken@naturallearning.net.au. Otherwise, if you haven't got all that, you can just ask Jeff and he'll put...
Yeah, get a hold of me and I'll put you in touch. And if you're going to be in Newcastle, you can show up at Nikki's house and feed the birds.
Plus, I tagged you on the Facebook post when you first started talking, so it should be fine.
We'll fight. And so this has been another episode of the Child Care Bar and Grill podcast. I'm Jeff Johnson. Thank you for listening. We'll be back soon with another episode. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
And...